So hello and welcome to Representations. You are entering the session featuring the Art History Babes. My name is Britt Royer, and I am the Marketing and the Membership Manager of St. Mary's College Museum of Art. Before I get started today, I would like to extend my gratitude to Sharon and the students at the Center for Women and Gender Equity for organizing this event and inviting the museum into this dialogue. I would also like to extend my gratitude to all of the collaborators for today's event. As many of you might know, this time last year, the museum planned on hosting the Art History Babes, and due to COVID, this was the first of many canceled programs of 2020. I cannot articulate enough how exciting it is to have them here today and to see this event unfold. The Art History Babes is a woman-owned podcasting platform exploring all things visual culture. Their work seeks to reconceptualize art and art history, challenging the elitism and traditional discourse with a fresh and current cultural lens. This past fall, the Babes published The Honest Art Dictionary, a jovial trip through art jargon. This dictionary collection of over 300 art terms breaks down the barriers of art history, examining language and the cultural undertones to uplift the subject into the modern era. The Art History Babes are made up of four friends: Corey Hendricks, Natalie De La Torre, an SMC alumna, Virginia Van Dyne, and Jennifer Gutierrez. They all met and began the podcast while studying for their master's degree in art history at UC Davis circa 2016. Nearly 5 years later, they've hosted and produced over 150 podcast episodes, spoken at art fairs, hosted live podcasts, and wrote their book. Their approach is that art history does not need to be elitist pursuit, and instead to try to make it the topic approachable, relatable, and accessible. For this event today, please enjoy. At 2:15, we will open the discussion to a Q&A with the Babes following a raffle of their book at 2:30. So please join me in welcoming Corey, Natalie, Ginny, and Jen, the Art History Babes.
Hello. Hello. Thank you, Britt.
Oh, Corey, you're muted.
There we go. Thanks, Jen. We are the hosts and producers of the Art History Babes podcast. I'm Corey. Thank you for that introduction, Britt. That was lovely. We are also the authors of the Honest Art Dictionary. And we have over the past 5 years created a platform that includes website and Instagram account. We have a YouTube channel. We have our Patreon, as well as our podcast, which was kind of where we started. We've built this platform on many ideas, but one of our core intentions has always been an accessible approach to the study of art and art history, and mostly just emphasizing that making art, appreciating art, learning about art, understanding the history of art is a pretty fundamental human pursuit, and that art can really be found everywhere. And we want art to be expansive and inclusive rather than limiting. So we do our best to break away from just typical Western art historical canon. And we also try to think about art in relation to bigger ideas of culture and just everyday life, being a human being, and how it interacts with our everyday life. And we've also been told we're fun and non-intimidating. So so that's kind of our whole vibe.
That's nice, Corey. Thank you for that. That's news to me that we are non-intimidating, actually. No, just kidding. Well, I just wanted to say I'm Jen for everybody. Hello. And thank you for hosting us, Britt, and St. Mary's College. This is awesome. A little bit about how we met. So as Britt mentioned, we did our master's degrees at UC Davis. We all began in 2015. I actually met Corey at all of our TA orientations, 2-day long classes that we have to take. There was a very instant like, yeah, you know, I feel you. And so we began in our small cohort. The program at UC Davis was on, there was maybe 12 of us, and our little group was, I think, 6 of us. Was it 6 of us? I don't know. We were small, but the 4 of us, we clicked pretty much instantly. And we had a difficult time adjusting to grad school, and we immediately were so grateful that we had these nice friends that we could talk to, and everybody just kind of could collectively commiserate about being in grad school. And we started to spend time together outside of our time on campus, and it started with just let's have some wine, and then we started having conversations that were really fun about what seminars we were taking, or literally just grad school and what that's like. And it was Corey who originally was like, we should record this. And then we bought a microphone, and we used to just pass it around as we would speak. And that was the early time that when it just became a thing, and then it started to really become a real podcast. So we were told more than once that our connection was unusual, that most people in our nation saw each other as rivals as opposed to teammates. And I feel grateful for having that mentality of like, we're a team and we can do this together. We don't have to be in competition with one another. And I think that made grad school horrible and fun.
Definitely. Yeah. Just kind of jumping off of what Jen was talking about, you know, in our sort of early inception of this podcast project that we've created. And like what Jen was saying, it really came from our just kind of collective love and enthusiasm for all getting together and talking about art. You know, there was certainly an element of kind of decompressing from being in grad school, but at its core, it was this really genuine love for art. And for me, at least, that was the first time that I had multiple friends who really liked art as well. You know, I have plenty of wonderful friends who will indulge me and talking about that, but this was the first time where it was like, wow, I'm hanging out with a bunch of people who like this as well. And, you know, I remember the particular night where we were all at a little local bar and restaurant in Davis, and we were telling different stories from art history. And one of my favorite artists is John Lorenzo Bernini, who's a 17th century Baroque Italian sculptor and architect. And I was telling this story about how he essentially caught his brother having an affair with his mistress, and chased his brother through the streets of Rome and almost beat him to death. And it's a very dramatic thing. I won't retell the whole story, but in that kind of telling and us just like telling stories and listening to stories came the idea of like, you know, we should record these conversations that we're having about art and art history, with the emphasis being on conversation. It's not meant to be formatted like a lecture or like a talk. It's really at its core friends talking about art, having a conversation. And we've been fortunate to get that feedback back from our listeners who feel like, you know, when they're listening to us, they're like sitting at a table and they're in on the conversation with us. So it really began as this fun hobby for us in grad school to kind of burn off stress, where we would just get together in, you know, one of our living rooms and drink wine and pick a topic to discuss. But as we further developed it and kept it up through grad school, you know, all through us doing our master's theses and all, you know, that entailed and TAing. So we maintained it through all that. And we really realized that we had tapped into something that, you know, the percentage of the population was craving, where, you know, an art focused podcast that, sorry, if you can hear that dog barking, that really is something that's not intimidating. It's very approachable, and it's also wide range in terms of the different kinds of art topics that we discuss. And we really try to branch out into visual culture at large and not just kind of stay within the little realm of art history. But I think, you know, we've all been very pleasantly surprised. I'm continually pleasantly surprised by this podcast and how far we've come, and how the reception has really been so wonderful and continued to grow.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, the best part, other than just kind of getting to hang out with our friends and talk about something that we all are so passionate about and nerdy about, is that we get to choose whatever that means. And that freedom and that kind of liberation of just getting to choose any topic and finding art anywhere is really fun. And it keeps us, you know, wanting to do this, and it keeps us from getting burnout for the most part. Not like there aren't plenty of challenges, but it helps. It helps to actually enjoy your work and enjoy what you're doing. And we feel very fortunate as art historians to get to do that and to get to have that freedom to bring art into people's homes, into people's lives, who might not otherwise be interested or just have access to that, you know, outside of college, outside of school. How often do you get to hear the topic of art history come up? So yeah, we are just happy to be able to inhabit this space, and that, you know, we found out that this is a space to inhabit. And we talk about everything on the show, if you're not familiar with it, from conventional art history stuff. We try to stay, we try to provide something that is educational. So we do episodes that are all related back to the AP art history exam to help people who are studying for that. But then we also get to talk about whatever else. So like, I think Ginny had mentioned graphic novels. We've gotten to talk about like TV shows that we like that have art, that incorporate art, anything. And that's just been such a blessing for us. And yeah, finding out that people want to listen to it and like it, I mean, it's like the biggest compliment. So just if someone's trying to get into our podcast or just check it out for the first time, we did a reboot of one of our very earliest episodes on the Gorilla Girls just recently. So that's like very easy to find, and it deals with the idea of feminism in the art world and just the struggles that female artists have had to deal with over the course of history and still to this day. They're a really cool arts group, so that's a good place to start if you guys would like. And I feel like it's in the theme of the symposium today.
All right, so yeah, that's kind of the rundown on how the podcast has developed. About 2 years ago now, two springs ago, we were approached to write this book by White Line Publishing, based in London, which also was just a wonderful, crazy thing that happened. And they asked us if we would be open to the concept of an art dictionary. And we all felt that that was a really perfect opportunity for, you know, our first book, and also for the structure of what we do. So we jumped at the chance, and the editor had listened to our podcast and felt that, you know, the collective voice would make for an interesting dictionary format. So it's structured like a dictionary, and it's broken up alphabetically. However, we pretty much depart from the classic dictionary at that point. Each term has its own definition. The definitions range from about 200 to 500 words. And as we did it, the structure of it, we all maintained our own individual voices when we wrote the entries. So the book is, we basically just split the entries. You know, we each picked up roughly the same number of words to define. And then we all edited each other's stuff a lot. So it was both individual and collaborative. And each entry, we mark with our first initial. So you know whose voice is speaking. And in that sense, it kind of reflects the podcast format, like each of us talking, but even at some points in the dictionary, we're kind of in conversation with each other, which is obviously very different from a typical dictionary. So it was really trying to reflect the entire energy of the podcast, how the podcast works, and finding that balance between individual and collective. And we also, it was just really important to us that it be, that it have humor to it. So there's lots of jokes, lots of references, like pop culture references are really huge. It's infused with a lot of our own opinions, but we also make that very clear that like when it's fact and when it's an opinion, to kind of make it more conversational, a more conversational dictionary, I guess.
Yeah. So the book itself is just this really beautiful, I'm really excited about the general aesthetic of the book because we're all 90s children. And when we saw the final product of the design of the book, we were just very excited. And a big part of what makes us so excited about this layout is also the art. So we have illustrations in our book that are by the artist Carmen Casado. And Carmen had a really interesting idea, which was to blend around three terms together in the illustrations. And at first we weren't so sure about what that was going to look like. So the publisher told us that that was the plan. And, but when we finally saw the mock-ups for these in the book, we were just blown away. So the one that you're seeing right now, that one is Ceramic Museum and Vanitas. So that's just an example of the, just the vision of the artist. The Frida Kahlo illustration that you're seeing there is a combination of diseño, headdress, and organic forms. So that's just really fun. So it was a very collaborative project in every sense of the word. It was certainly challenging to write and edit together at times, especially with our background in academia. It's not something that I think you typically do a lot in the humanities, where you're writing in conjunction with other people and everyone's input goes into your individual writing. And so we really learned this overall collaborative nature to the book was going to really take us far. And so with our background with writing independent research papers or theses, this was different, but ultimately became so rewarding in the end. And the book would not be what it is without all of our voices in it, everyone's input. So what you really see in the Honest Art Dictionary is a creativity, collaboration, and friendship and love. It was made of love. And so, yeah, I think we're going to read a couple of passages.
Yeah. So the first one we wanted to read, just to kind of go with the theme of the symposium, was the definition for feminist art. So here we are. Every definition of feminist art seems to be a little bit, some a lot of bit, different. Some define feminist art as art that intentionally engages with feminist theory. Yes. While others define feminist art as art that specifically focuses on a woman's identity and experiences. No. Like so many terms used to describe genres of art, the term feminist art is often rejected by the artists it's meant to define. Many women artists refuse the label, making the excellent point that art by women about women is often labeled feminist art, while art by men about men is labeled art. Additionally, not all women artists wish to be categorized according to a socio-political movement that they may or may not adhere to. Fair. Therefore, since this is our book and we can do what we want, we're going to take the opportunity to amend the terminology to the best of our abilities. Feminist art is art that intentionally engages with feminist issues and is most often associated with the second wave feminism of the 1960s and 70s. Feminist art sought to bring women's perspectives to the table. A particularly notable and literal example of this is Judy Chicago's The Dinner Party, 1974 to 79. A massive triangular banquet table set with 39 places, each one for a different stand-up gal from history. Chicago utilized traditional domestic crafts such as ceramics and needlework to bring attention to the historical contributions of women in the arts. The goal of feminist art is to create a dialogue surrounding issues that were brought to light by feminist theory of the 1970s, such as women's representation in the art world, women's sexuality and eroticism, matriarchy, criticism of male violence and patriarchal values, and challenging historical portrayals of women in art. The work of feminist artists of the 1960s and 1970s helped to knock down barriers and provide space for future women artists. However, as we move into a world of intersectionality, we may want to give extra consideration to what we label feminist art. Goddess bless.
Thank you, Corey. That was perfect. I'm going to just read one more, just to give you a little taste of what are the different sort of tenor to our entries. So this one is Kuros or Corey, and I'm going to read it because Corey just read hers, and this is my little tribute to Corey in our book. Kuros or Kore, noun. A beautiful Greek hunk of man made out of marble. But wait, I'm at a museum, not on a beach in Mykonos. Oh, I must be admiring a Kuros. In ancient Greek, Kuros means youth or youthful boy, specifically a youth who is pubescent and ready to join the ranks of the adult male community. The ancient Greeks produced kuroi, or kuroi, I said the same thing twice, that's fine, plural for kuros, abundantly during the Archaic era from 600 to 480 BCE. And they are some of the earliest examples of ancient Greek monumental figure sculptures. These statues were almost always standing in the nude and are likely to have been either votive or commemorative in nature. However, they do not tend to have any distinguishing features, which begs the question, who or what is being commemorated here? One popular theory is that the Kuros is an ancient Greek sculptural type that celebrates the beauty of the masculine youthful bod. The Kuros also has a female counterpart, the Kore, or Korai, plural, which means maiden in ancient Greek. Shout out to Corey, whose name is derived from the Corey. Unlike the Kuros, a Corey is always clothed in thick, sometimes elaborate drapery, and tends to have an extended arm. Unfortunately, these arms are mostly broken off, which leaves historians in the dark as to what they may have been holding. This only deepens the mystery as to who these figures were meant to represent. Perhaps the Kuros and Kore are meant to embody archetypal Greek ideals of masculinity and femininity. We really don't know, but we can glean from their slight little smiles, called the Archaic smile, that they hold a secret that has been lost to time.
Beautiful. Yeah, and so talking a bit about kind of our position, and I think what this book really encapsulates is sort of this position that we hold in between like the real professional kind of academic high art world and more of the fringe, and how we really like to occupy that space that is more approachable and connects to more things. You know, like we definitely, I mean, obviously we come from an academic background, and we're very familiar with a lot of aspects of the sort of polished contemporary art world, but we're really a lot more interested in bringing art history to people who may have had little to no interaction with the discipline, or might be unfamiliar or somewhat kind of intimidated by the art world, which can be at times very, I think, alienating and intimidating to people. Like there's that feeling like, oh, like I don't get it, or I don't know how to access it, or really like, I feel like I'm not understanding it. And so we really want to encourage and attract people from outside of the art world into our kind of listenership. And that just opens up a lot of different interpretations that I think are very much of value to the art world at large. And, you know, we really have the belief that art and visual material shape our everyday lives, and therefore everyone can be an art historian. Everyone can value, analyze, gain inspiration from the visual material that we consume every day and connect it to society and history at large, really.
Yeah, and I mean, a lot are in line with the symposium, and today in general, the last year has been very challenging by way of, you know, interacting face-to-face. And luckily, that's something we already had a little bit of experience with. Corey lives in the Midwest, and Ginny and I are all here in California. So we've been recording and doing this remote and long distance for a while now, and hopefully not forever. But it did help us in the last year to, you know, not really be overly affected by everything going on. And it also just, virtual education, we think, is kind of the way of the future. And we want to have a space making that more accessible, like we've kind of said a few times. So accessible in the way that people are comfortable listening to us and don't feel alienated or disconnected from the things that we talk about. We try to be very relatable, but also accessible in the way that people can just get it. And it's, you know, our podcast is free, and it's something you can download on your phone, on your computer. It's very easy to get. And it's also something that we've gotten really good at doing long distance, and just finding a way to incorporate art history into our everyday lives and getting to share that with people, whether it's through Zoom and the internet or hopefully in person again very, very soon. But virtual, you know, exhibiting, virtual presenting, all of this is something that we're comfortable with and enjoy doing, and, you know, are very flattered to be here today, honored to be invited. And yeah, we have something exciting that we're working on that Ginny is going to get into a little bit that also has to do with virtual exhibiting. And if you haven't already checked out Britt's show that she exhibited or that she curated at the gallery, there's, yeah, plenty of beautiful artwork to see there that you can see from the comfort of your computer, and check out all that goodness about the Sublime. And if you got our book, you can read about the Sublime there as well. So yeah, just excited to be on the internet and here in this space. Corey.
Yeah, I mean, pretty much, you know, ditto to everything you just said, but it's been interesting because this platform, the concept of it, when we really got going way back in, you know, 5 years ago now, virtual education was at the center of it. And that was way before our current, you know, complicated situation. We've always believed in the momentum of virtual education and how it is really taking over in a lot of ways and how it's very powerful. And wanting to use social media as a tool to educate, use these different forms of the internet, use our corner of the internet as a tool to educate in a new or somewhat different way. Something we also believe very strongly in, and we talk about it on the show, but we're in an interesting space where people like to kind of naysay social media or different platforms that are popular. But like anything else, we think it's a tool. It's a tool for education. It's a tool for art. Like you can do a lot with Instagram, with TikTok, now we're seeing with TikTok becoming like a very viable art platform, which is really an interesting thing. And it's easy to just, you know, brush aside. It's just like, you know, a bunch of teenagers like dancing, but that's not what it is at all. So we're really interested in our space and virtual space as a tool for education and for art. And we want to continue to explore that in as many ways as we possibly can. And we have something very exciting and new happening that Jenny is heading up. Would you like to talk about that, Jen?
Sure. Yeah, I started thinking over the summer that I wanted to curate an online digital exhibition through the Art History Babes platform. And I was inspired to do that because I had worked with in writing an exhibition catalog essay for Kristen Huff, who's also a Davis MFA alum, and she's part of a collective called Outback Art House, and they do virtual studio visits and they produce virtual exhibitions as well. And so in writing the exhibition catalog for that, it really got me thinking that you know, art already is being viewed more and more digitally and virtually than it was before, and that we have such a great listener base and people who follow us on Instagram, and I know many of them are creators and artists. And so I've partnered up with another Davis alum, our friend Zach Clark, who is the head of National Monument Press, which is a Rezo printing platform. And so the two of us came up with this exhibition that we've titled Virtual Realism. And it really came from thinking and talking a lot about socialist realism, which is an art period from Stalin era Soviet Union, so around 1930s through 80s or 1940s through 80s, and how it's very kind of bright, saturated art that's all about like mandated idealism, and, you know, it's all presented as being very, everyone's happy, everyone's having a great time, but with this real underhand of propaganda and control. And that just got us really thinking about, okay, what are the ways in which, even though it comes from this period, that this art movement from the past, but it brings up a lot of ideas that I think we can all relate to now, especially in more digital age, with things like influencers on Instagram and the power of imagery and what that tries to evoke or coax or control. And so we've intentionally made the theme of it somewhat broad, because we want to see a lot of different interpretations of that. But we're currently in the open call phase, and the deadline is April 10th. And you can find the page for it on theArtHistoryBabes.com, and it's its own tab, Virtual Realism. And it has that description of the show there. And it's a really simple two-step application process. You know, we wanted to keep in mind that, you know, curating shows like this, creating digital exhibition catalogs, selecting the artwork, and we're also, in conjunction with all of that, releasing podcast episodes where we talk with other curators and artists about the process of curating your own show. So like, if you want to curate your own online exhibition, like here are some ways that we did it. So we very much want to still have that education element involved in this. So you can visit that page on our website. Thank you, Britt, for putting that in the chat. And so we wanted to have it be very accessible for people to apply to, but also keeping in mind that, you know, curation is a lot of work. So the first step is to subscribe to the Art History Babes Patreon, which you can do for as little as $1 a month. And then after you've subscribed, if you aren't already subscribed to our Patreon, there's a really simple Google form, and we're open to all mediums, including like written mediums, like if you have a poem or flash fiction, photography, painting, sculpture. So it's very open-ended. And we're just excited to get the artwork in and kind of see what comes together. And then we'll publish it on the website, on the Art History Babes. And we have plans to do more virtual exhibitions like this in the future. So if you subscribe to our Patreon at that $1 level, from there and up, you're eligible to submit to future exhibitions that we curate. So it's a new kind of avenue of exploration that we're doing that I'm really excited about, and I think has a lot of potential for the future for the Art History Babes platform. So, yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah. And then we kind of just had some fun little tips and stuff for approaching art, for approaching art spaces that we just wanted to share with you guys. So, the first one is to follow your curiosity and just genuinely don't do anything else. Like, don't judge yourself. Don't stop looking into something because maybe it doesn't fit into your traditional idea or definition of what art or even art history is. Obviously, we just decided to make art history work for our lives instead of, you know, needing to fit into a box. So follow your curiosities, whatever they may be, and they lead to really exciting places in our experience, at least.
Definitely. And obviously, you know, as art historians, like we do love context. We love learning. We love getting added layers of meaning, and context is amazing and it's valuable. But at times it can also bog you down if you're not able to separate from it. In undergrad, one of my favorite professors would always talk about how much she loved teaching undergrads because they had fresh eyes. So they would often have creative insights that she just couldn't see or think about because she had been studying it, you know, from an academic contextual standpoint for so long. And so sometimes I think it's good to intentionally, even if you are someone who studies art history, to try and step back and find your own fresh eye space to kind of just see what happens, as opposed to kind of what Natalie was saying, as opposed to getting bogged down in what you think the meaning is or what you think the right answer is.
To speak to that, to the context and all of that, it is also important to not let your head get in the way when you're approaching art. There is a lot of self-judgment that pops up in the world of academia and art history, where maybe you will walk into a gallery and you like something, but it maybe isn't what you think is your or what makes fine art or what have you. So if you are at all interested in entering the world of art, but you don't feel like you have that background, it doesn't matter. Just go for it. You will more than certainly find something that you're drawn to. And later you can figure out the context and why maybe you like it, but it's okay to just like something because it looks nice.
Totally. I think a big thing for us too, and that I always suggest, is you know, finding like-minded people and especially being very open to collaborating on creative projects with your friends. That's how we did this. You know, all of us, this was very much a collective effort, you know, from creating the podcast to building the podcast to making the book. And so really just encouraging everyone, you know, who has like ideas, like I want to make this thing, or I, you know, want to do this, and just talking to other like friends who will get excited about that as well. Cause you can really make things happen. Like you can really make things happen from that. So I'm always a proponent of, you know, brainstorming with your friends, talking with your friends, like troubleshooting things and really being open to the creative collaborative process at large, because some really cool stuff can happen because of it.
Yeah, and it's nice in comparison to the kind of isolating feeling that can come along when you're writing a paper, you're really deep into a personal project. And while, you know, there's a lot of benefit to doing things individually, we have found a lot of benefit in doing things together too. And like the podcast, the book, all of it is such a collaborative thing. And like everyone brings different things to the table. So it's just, yeah, hang out with your friends, talk about art, talk about things you like. That's what we advocate.
Definitely.
Last tip that I feel like is just like a solid life tip. It's pretty common, like as you get deeper into studying art or the art world or making art in any capacity. And then also I think this applies to like social media. It applies to a lot of aspects of life, but you're likely to run into people with more elitist mindsets or intellectual superiority that they want to express to you. In which case, you know, don't let that keep you from liking what you like and liking what you make. You know, don't let the haters get you down. Like, it's gonna happen. Just like feel strong in what you're doing. Obviously there's a difference between like valuable criticism and like someone just being a hater. Be open to like people who are giving you valuable feedback, but you know, there are also those times where people just want to show you how smart they are and how much they know compared to you. And in those instances, you know, just take a deep breath and keep working on what you know you should be working on. It's definitely been a process for us too. I think from the beginning, how we handled those kinds of remarks or people like that to now, it's been a huge learning curve. So yeah, just, you know, do what excites you, do what, you know, ignites your soul.
Yes.
Did we lose Jen?
We might have. This is perfect. This is very like on brand. I feel like losing Jen for a minute. She'll be back.
Oh man.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did we want to do Q&A, or was there?
Yeah, we can transition into our Q&A time. If you feel comfortable unmuting yourself and asking a question, or if you would like to leave it in the chat, please feel free. I did want to start out because I have a question for you. I'm curious, what has been one of your favorite podcasts to work on, and what was it about?
Ooh. The one we did the fairly recently, we did one on hostile architecture, which was a really interesting episode. And just a little quick background, hostile architecture is typically a kind of urban design in cities that's meant to, it's primarily targeted at homeless people. So it'll be, you know, bars dividing benches, spikes installed in entryways. And that just opened up a lot of discussion for us and just, kind of thinking about the ways, you know, because we talk so much about the benefits of design and architecture and art to create, you know, to welcome people, to make people feel good. And, you know, it's, I think, just as valuable to talk about design that's meant to control or exclude. And that just brings up a lot of, you know, really worthwhile topics of discussion. So I'm proud of that episode that we did recently, and it was also good to learn more about. And especially, I live in San Francisco, so hostile architecture is all around me, and it's one of those things that you might not notice on your day to day, but once you read about it, then you see it everywhere, and you just realize how ubiquitous it is in our country and lots of places all around the world. But that's a recent favorite of mine.
Can I piggyback on that question? This is Sharon, by the way. Thank you all for being here. That's fascinating, because I think we all walk by, including me, every day, and we see these. And I've thought about, like, when I'm with my children, this would be more comfortable if it was different. But you're telling us it's intentional. And I wonder if you can elaborate and talk about why you think that might be especially important for us to notice things like hostile architecture that will make the unhoused population more uncomfortable as more and more people have been pushed into that situation in these, like, pandemic struggling times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's a very good point. And, you know, I think we're very mindful of that in recording and just, you know, already just speaking to the Bay Area, you know, homelessness has been an incredible problem, and it's gotten much, much worse over the last 2 years. And then obviously with all the hardships of this past year with the pandemic, you know, it's interesting too, because, you know, there are so many of these really big office buildings in downtown areas that have been somewhat shuttered. But when that starts opening back up again, I had said when we were recording this podcast that I was somewhat concerned that there would be even more hostile architecture being implemented in cities once things kind of go back to business as usual. And, you know, we also talked about how not only is hostile architecture targeting homeless people, but it's also quite ableist. So, you know, it's making public spaces, it's harder to sit down and rest. You know, more benches are made kind of like vertical or weird shapes so that you can sort of lean against it. And it's by and large just creating these sort of urban centers that are very inhospitable to a lot of different people, and just really questioning why that is done and why people feel the need to do that. Is, I think,
especially in space that's supposed to be public, that's supposed to be, you know, welcoming or for everyone in theory. So then that starts, you know, if that's being challenged, then we should take note of that and maybe have some feelings about it.
For sure.
And we have feelings about it.
Yep, you can hear them all on that episode.
Well, and I won't, I don't want to take up too much space. I could probably just ask you questions all day, but there's other people here too. But I wonder if you can talk about are there any like public movements or counter movements to kind of work toward making public space truly accessible to the public to get rid of the, or transition the hostile architecture spaces to something more user-friendly?
So I haven't come across many organizations that are directly countering hostile architecture itself. What I found more were alternatives in terms of there are several architecture and design firms across the world that have been trying to make anti-hostile architecture. So things as simple as creating a flap and a latch on public benches so that at night someone can sleep on the bench and pull that top over so that they have coverage at night. There were also benches that could pull up kind of like an accordion where, you know, it sandwiches down so you can sit on it during the day, and at night it can pop up and be a little shelter for the night. There were a few other design ideas similar to that, where it was creating shelters off the side of housing. So you were using already established housing as like a kind of point of structure and stability. And, you know, all of these ideas that I've seen, a lot of them were either proposals or temporary projects that different cities were trying out. And, you know, there seems to be quite a long way to go in terms of getting those implemented more regularly or on a more permanent basis. I'm not aware of organizations that are trying to dismantle hostile architecture that already exists. We did talk about skateboarders and how a lot of them are really good at disassembling elements of hostile architecture, but I'm sure they're out there. I would need to look into them more, but I'm sure they're out there. And there's one nonprofit project in Vancouver, British Columbia, called the Rainy Days Project, and they're the ones who built those benches. And I know there are other organizations like that, and I'm sure there are some in the Bay Area as well that would be worth looking into, I'm sure.
Yeah, I don't know a ton, but there are some like smaller activist groups. And one that I know operates in the Midwest, where I am, is Midwesterners Against the Middle Bar, and they're talking about like the middle bar in on
benches.
So I mean, I think it's a pretty small collective, but there are definitely activist collectives that are focusing on it a little bit.
So we have a few hands raised. Let's start with Luke. Would you like to share your question?
Yes, actually. I had a few questions mainly related to the Gothic period of artwork. I'm a big fan of, I guess what you call the medieval kind of, I'm not sure what the specific word in the art world is, but Gothic architecture, you know, where it's like all kind of metal and baroque, and it's very kind of grim, and it has that very heavy emphasis on religiousness and kind of, I want to say, a certain bleakness. One of the art pieces I really, really liked, I'm pretty sure you already know of it. It's the, what was it? It was the Garden of Delights. I think you've heard of it. It's where it has the really surreal imagery of like the weird combinations of humans and weird hybrids of mutants and things. It's a very famous painting. I'm very much interested in the Gothic, or the kind of that weird, strange, experimental phase of artwork.
Can you say the name of the artwork again?
Yes, I believe it's called The Garden of Delights. I can't remember its exact...
Garden of Earthly Delights.
Yeah, Garden of Earthly Delights.
So, funny thing about that one, by Hieronymus Bosch, that's actually not a medieval work. It's from the Northern Renaissance. And the Northern Renaissance is really, really fun and has a lot of artwork. A lot of the artwork is made during that Renaissance period. But you are spot on in associating it with a medieval artwork, because the North, like Belgium, Germany, all those kind of Northern European countries, they had a real weird take on the Renaissance and were making these just sort of expansive landscapes of all kinds of little people moving around. If you're interested in Hieronymus Bosch, who did the Garden of Earthly Delights, you probably also would enjoy Peter Bruegel. Those are some fun artists working in the Northern Renaissance tradition. So it sounds like you're pulling some joy from the Northern Renaissance. So I would encourage you to look into that.
Thank you. That was basically my question.
On Bosch?
Oh yeah, we also have an episode on Hieronymus Bosch. So
check it out.
Yep. Oh, okay. Very much. Yeah, cool. If you can drop like a link and, I'll check it out. I'm a huge fan of podcasts.
Awesome.
Thank you.
I like this one.
Great. Would William like to go next?
Yeah. One of the things that's fascinated me most about the art world in general, and this ties into when concepts like elitism were mentioned earlier, the idea of kitsch art, of basically the line of what counts as art and what doesn't. My fiance is an artist. She went to an art school in Bulgaria. And I haven't had this discussion with her, but I want to be smart in talking with her about it. And like an example that comes to mind that I'm sure you're all familiar with is like Jeff Koons' art, I think. The mm-hmm. giant balloon animals. And honestly, mm-hmm. I would kind of agree with that assessment personally. He himself stated they don't mean anything. But I would be very curious as to see like what all of you think about the concept of kitsch art, where the line is, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
What the purpose of genuine art is. As for me, it's just an art is genuine if it evokes emotion and not just to try and bait somebody, like if it's actually trying to make somebody feel something.
Yeah, that's a big question.
I know. I'm sorry.
No, you're good. We love kitsch. We love this topic. Big
question, yeah. And also one that we have talked about a bit on the podcast. Kitsch is, it's just something that evokes very strong opinions from people. People like feel very passionately about kitsch a lot of the time. Where it belongs in the hierarchy of art. I think we probably all have slightly different opinions based on the actual artwork in question. Like personally, I have a lot of love for a lot of kitsch artwork. I can go pretty deep into it. I'm big in finding the depth in art that other people think isn't deep. That's like a big thing for me.
I admire that immensely. I draw the line once the artists themselves say there isn't any meaning.
Yeah.
Yeah, but we're also not the biggest Jeff Koons fans.
I appreciate that.
I'm not a fan of Jeff Koons. So, you know, that's not a catch-all answer, but I do like to find the depth in art that gets relegated to the margins. I really love outsider art, and a lot of outsider art is typically considered kitschy, which is something I tend to fight back on. But yeah, it is complicated. We recently did an episode on holiday kitsch, like specifically kitsch in a holiday context, because we're kind of bombarded by it in the winter months. And one term that ended up coming up, I think might have been Nat, was the idea of rich kitsch and the idea of like kitsch. Was it? But the idea of like kitsch is a little more hollow and is just trying to express like I have a lot of money or something, that kind of being its own thing. But I guess ultimately my take is I think kitsch is a fascinating world, and one that like it's a shame that we just kind of brush it aside, because I think there's so much to be talked about there personally.
Mm-hmm. It's really interesting.
Cool. So I think we have one more question. Lindsay, would you like to share?
Yeah, thanks. So you mentioned earlier in the conversation about art and TV shows, and I'm not much of an art history person, but I love TV shows. So could you, each of you, like recommend a TV show that has great artwork in it? Thank you.
BoJack.
BoJack Horseman. We have a whole episode on it. And I mean, the entire show itself is artwork. And then on top of that, they actually incorporate art into a lot of the storyline, and just when they can, it's very fun. If you haven't watched BoJack Horseman, I cannot recommend it enough. I hadn't seen it at the time of the episode too, so I really want to go back and listen to that, because now I've seen it like maybe 10 times through. It's on all the time at my house. If you follow us on Instagram, you've probably seen it in our stories, but that is a great place to start. What are some other ones?
There's
talk about drunk history.
Oh. Is this a popcorn event or are we just listening? Okay, good. Oh, can I? Oh, I just wanted to ask if I could offer one.
Yeah.
Depending
on what you're looking for in terms of experimental art, there is a very, very well-known YouTuber who does a set of highly original and highly hand-drawn animation. You may have heard of the Elephant's Garden or Double King. Have you ever heard of either of those?
I have not. No, that sounds interesting though. The Elephant's Garden. I'm going to check that out.
Yeah, he's a hand-drawn specialist who does all of his own animation. And he typically takes like 2 to 3 years at a time to do a single animation, but they're all exquisitely drawn and they evoke a classic experimental animation effect. You know, at the time with like movies like Pink Floyd's The Wall and the animation that it had, and a lot of old classic 80s movies, animated movies. It's a very experimental and very trippy kind of effect. I don't recommend doing anything while you're watching it because it is surreal.
We'll definitely try that out. That sounds cool.
Good to know. Thank you.
What We Do in the Shadows is another one.
Oh,
mm-hmm. Yes. Corey and I did was that a Hot Takes episode?
Yep.
Yeah.
I love that movie.
Yeah, it's a great movie. And we love the movie and we love the TV show, and both of those have a lot of art throughout, and they do a lot of kind of like funny references to art historical works that they then like will insert their own little faces. And if people are unaware, What We Do in the Shadows originally was a movie by Taika Waititi and Jemaine Clement, two New Zealand comedians, and it's formatted like a mockumentary about vampires. And it's very goofy and it's great for people who like spooky things, but also like it's very lighthearted and funny, but there's a lot of great art historical references throughout, and just the whole TV show and movie are beautiful in terms of like the sets and the props and all that. It's visually very fun. So that's one I would recommend.
Great. So, well, first of all, we are at 2:32. So I want to thank you all for the time and for sharing with us your work and your process. And if there are any additional questions that you all may have, just rush them in the chat real quick, and maybe during the break we can get to them. But there is a break now, and I believe I am going to hand it over for our raffle for a potential art history book.
Okay. Yes, just 1 minute, and I will share the screen and pull up my random number generator.
One of the things that you were sharing early on, and when you were reading an excerpt from your, I'm so sorry, I'm forgetting the official title of your book, and I want to quote it properly.
The Honest Art Dictionary.
The Honest Art Dictionary. You're reading the excerpt about art, and you said there's art, or there's feminist art. And it's really interesting, right? Because we hear people do this all the time. There's doctors, and then there's a woman doctor, or things like that. But art is the thing that sometimes people would be like, oh, okay, of course that person's going to do art. They're a woman. They would do that field as opposed to something else. So I don't even know how to craft this, like this abstract idea into a question, but how is it that even art is not exempted from this kind of binary thinking around what is for which gender? From your perspectives.
I would say a lot of that is actually like art history is kind of to blame to a certain degree, how art has been written about. You know, the artists, you know, I don't think it's any surprise to people anymore that like the vast majority of artists that we have lifted up throughout history are white men. And pretty much everyone else has not gotten the same amount of attention. And so once whenever someone that didn't fit that world of like being a white male artist, then they would get a descriptor, right? Like, you're this kind of artist. You'd get mm-hmm. described by, you know, whatever identity applies. And in this exact example, you know, we're talking specifically about feminist art and how art by women often gets thrown into the or thrown under the term feminist art, even if that's not how the artist sees it, even if it's just art that's exploring a woman's experience, well, then it's feminist art, which isn't necessarily fair because feminism is a complex, you know, socio-political ideology. So there's definitely, I think at the root of it, it's the issue of trying to fit things into boxes and trying to like define, you know, it's kind of like the issue of definition. And when you look at the history of art history, we kind of just started at the baseline of like men make art, and then like, and then we started adding other people in. And so the problem goes back centuries, honestly. I obviously think it's getting better all the time. We're trying to do a better job of equity in the art world as well as everywhere else. But it's still just, you know, it's the issue of just going straight to the hierarchy that has been created.
And like Corey was talking about, like, it's important to bring attention to how history and the way that we talk about things shape our perception of how they actually were and how that is not an actual representation. So, you know, there, it's not that women have been, you know, making less art or inferior at making art over the years. It's that they just, you know, weren't spoken about in the same way that men were. They weren't praise. And that's for, yeah, a lot of societal reasons that has nothing to do with their ability to make great art. And so, just starting to recognize that we have a lot of misconceptions and just trying to combat them as we can. And gender is just a huge one that we're obviously still working on right now and in current times, trying to figure out why we're so like attached to this binary and trying to dismantle that.
Thank you.
I have a real quick question for you, and it's a little bit heavier, but I'm curious about your name and if you have received any criticism or backlash in some ways because of how you framed language around your title.
Good question. I feel as though we have gotten a little bit of feedback in the past about I keep going back to this iTunes review that we got a bunch of years ago where this angry person said that we were the cackling hen house of the bourgeoisie. I think about it, like I'll just be walking down the street and I'll be like hen house of the bourgeoisie. And we've gotten some haters that have said a couple of things, and the name of our podcast really came about because when we were in grad school, we just called each other babe. We were just babes. What's up, babe? You know, and it was a term of endearment, and it has stuck. And I believe that there are people out there who have sort of diminished us as like serious scholars because we call ourselves the art history babes. And to them, I say, whatever.
That's kind of the point, right? Like, it's funny to me that people would look at our name and want to diminish what we have to say by that. And mm-hmm. that's like ultimately their loss, you know, because they can't hold something that they think to be paradoxical to be true. So like to us, it's always been art history babes is just a playful term. Literally, I remember, I think one of the first photos I posted on Instagram with Ginny right when we started grad school was like my art history babe. Like it just was like a cute thing that we called each other and we're like, this is perfect. And then it became the name of our community. It'd be like, because we also get a lot of really nice messages and emails. I was like, you know, I love you, babes. Like, hey, babes. Like, it's a very endearing thing from our audience as well. And then you get people who are kind of haters about it. And then I think we have some people that are like middle of the road. Like, I don't know what to think about this, but they don't brush us off because of it, which is fair. Mm-hmm. Like, if it, you know, elicits something to you, that's fine. To us, it's very much, it was just a playful name that is a term of endearment and thus reflects what we're trying to do with the show, right? Like, bring complicated academic ideas into a fun, comfortable space. So,
and I think it's also kind of subversive because the idea of like a babe is just so like entrenched in this sort of almost like a misogynist point of view. And so we flipped it, you know, we flipped it and reversed it. And now it's our thing. And I, you know, I've had some people be like, well, you know, aren't you like 32? Like, you're still calling yourself babe. I'm like, yeah, babes forever. What are you talking about?
Well, thank you again for taking the time to share your work and your process with us. And I hope everyone has a lovely day.